Welcome to this special Atheist and Christian Book Club edition of Apologetics Profile. This is a monthly rebroadcast of Watchman Fellowship's Atheist and Christian Book Club, a gathering of both skeptics and believers who get together each month to discuss books and topics from both a Christian and an atheist perspective. If you would like to watch the video of this month's broadcast, be sure to visit our book club's website at atheistchristianbookclub.com. That's atheistchristianbookclub.com for various meetings on video. If you'd like to join us live for our monthly book club, it's free and easy. Just visit the link watchman.org/zoom. That's watchman.org/zoom to participate in our club meetings live.
Welcome to the Atheist and Christian Book Club. My name is James Walker. I'm president of Watchman Fellowship, an evangelical apologetics Christian ministry focused on mostly on interfaith evangelism. And I am also co-founder along with Bill Cluck. We're both co-founders of the Atheist and Christian Book Club. Welcome to the club. What we are is a monthly gathering of believers and skeptics respectfully discussing important books from both perspectives. And then we will have some dialogue, Q&A. We often try to have the author involved whenever possible, either by video conferencing or many times in person when we were meeting in person. We're not doing that right now because of the virus. But it has given us an opportunity to get outside of the North Texas area and have participants as far away as India and Africa. So welcome to the book club. Those of you who were with us last month know that we looked at the anthology by John Loftus called The Case Against Miracles. And John joined us and discussed his book, and it was a pretty interesting conversation, I thought. And so what we want to do, again, to have the other side of the story, this is the atheist perspective. So this evening we're going to be talking about the opposite, a case for miracles. And our guest is Craig Keener. Dr. Keener is the author of a massive 1,202-volume work called Miracles, The Credibility of the New Testament Accounts. It goes way beyond the New Testament, just looking at the miracles of the New Testament. It deals with the subject of miracles philosophically. There's a huge section on David Hume and his case against miracles. There is a lot of heavily documented worldwide research and information accounts of miracles taking place literally all over the world. And so there's nothing like that I'm aware of like this out there, this two-volume, heavily researched, highly documented book on miracles. So Dr. Keener holds a PhD from Duke University. He's a professor of biblical studies at Asbury Seminary. He is a New Testament scholar, writer of numerous commentaries. His expertise is in New Testament background, Acts, historical Jesus, which we've had several book clubs on that topic. Miracles, of course, tonight's topic, the Gospels, ethnic racial reconciliation, education. I could go on and on. He's authored 28 books, six of them have won awards in Christianity Today, of which together more than 1 million copies of his works are in circulation. So very busy man, but he was gracious enough to take time out of his schedule to come and join the book club. The book we're looking at is actually Lee Strobel's book, The Case for Miracles, but we were focused in on the three chapters, which were based on the interview that Lee Strobel did with Craig Keener. So he's here to talk about that. I've got some questions too, also from his two-volume work that I like to ask if time allows. So I just want to thank Dr. Keener for taking his time to be with us and say welcome to the Atheist and Christian Book Club.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, I know that our co-founder has some questions he's been really wanting to ask. Even before the program started, he was wanting to ask you some questions. So we're going to get to him in just a moment. But before we do, Dr. Kinder, could you just take a minute and talk about, you know, what put this whole topic of miracles, what put this on your heart? What made you so interested in it that you would produce this work? Give us a little background.
Well, I mean, I was interested in it once I became a Christian, in any case. But the reason that I was that I wrote the two-volume book actually was just because it comes up in terms of it's one of the objections that people sometimes raise against historical reliability of the Gospels and Acts. They say, well, you know, otherwise we would take them more seriously, but look, they have miracle accounts. And these couldn't possibly come from eyewitnesses. And so I was just going to have like a footnote, but the footnote kept growing and growing and ended up being that big book. The book itself actually took a few years of research, drew on 4,000 sources. But the primary question of the book, do eyewitnesses report the sort of events today that are reported in the New Testament? And so I was just surveying a cross-section of those claims. Obviously, I didn't interview hundreds of millions of people, but just to see what kinds of miracles or miracle claims are reported. And nobody would claim that all of them actually were miracles, but at least to see what kind of claims were being reported. And some of them were really significant. Well, a lot of them were really significant. And some of the claims fit Hume's standard of respectable witnesses with something to lose, whose integrity I could evaluate. Often there was medical certification. So the first question was, can eyewitnesses report things like this? And I think that isn't so controversial. The secondary argument, which when I started writing the book, I wasn't planning to address, but eventually I became so convinced myself, I said, okay, it's going to be disingenuous for me not to show my hand, you know, where I stand on this. The separate question is, for a number of these cases, is special divine action actually the logically most economical explanation for these events? Hume argued that uniform human experience makes miracle claims unbelievable, but I don't think that would be the basis for his argument today. Because when you have hundreds of millions of claims, you can't start with a premise of what is uniform human experience. You have to explore it rather than take that as a starting point.
So the idea is that some critics, skeptics, will want to just dismiss the Bible as a kind of a genre of literature that doesn't at all parallel the world that we live in. So special, you know, dragons, miracles, and it's kind of a fantasy genre. And then you come into the real world, and what you're showing in your book, your two-volume work, is that, no, you know, we're seeing very similar reports of miracles. Some of them can be substantiated, at least on some level. And even if all of these reports are not true, nevertheless, the idea is this is not so different than the world that's being described today. Well, the co-founder of our Atheist and Christian Book Club is Bill Kluck. Bill Kluck is a former Christian, now atheist. I called him early today an open-minded atheist, and I do believe that he is. It's good, I think, to be an open-minded atheist and an open-minded Christian. It beats being a closed-minded or fundamentalist in both cases. But I want to—I have some more questions for you, and I know the room has questions as well. But I wanted to give Bill a chance to open up from an atheist perspective and ask you some questions on the book. So, Bill,
I wanted to start off by saying, I got to confess, I did see a miracle when I was 30 years old. I was in Durham, North Carolina. I was dating an aerobics teacher, and she broke her collarbone wrestling some guy. I mean, she was a kind of a manly guy or whatever. But so we went to the doctor, and he said 6 to 8 weeks, which you would expect of a collarbone. And she said, I will be teaching aerobics in 2 days. And I went, sure you will. 2 days later, she's teaching aerobics. And I'm just stunned. I'm like, this, she had a broken, we had x-rays and everything. Similar to what you've experienced, doctor, you got a lot of objective evidence, which I'm, you know, very impressed with and very open to. So anyway, so she's like totally healed in 2 days. I go to the doctor, he was at the aerobics class. I went, hey doc, what's the deal here? And she's teaching aerobics, she has a broken collarbone. And he goes, she's a mighty healer. And I go, is that all you got? Can't you give me a little bit more credit? So
as an atheist, how do you compartmentalize that? How do you is it just an anomaly or something that you just say, well, one day I'll know what really happened. It only appeared to be supernatural, but there's a good natural explanation for it. Or, I mean, how do you do that and without cognitive dissonance?
Well, to quote James Walker, I just put it on a shelf and, you know, I'll address it, wait till more evidence comes in. Is that okay?
Yeah, I do hear that a lot.
Ken, Daniels, help me out. I need Ken, please help me. Oh, that's a good point. It seems like amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I just didn't know if you had had a way of doing that. And, you know, I gave you that illustration when I was a Mormon that I would put things on the shelf. And eventually what happens is your shelf collapses under the weight. You put too much on it. So, I'd be curious to how you deal with that.
See, you don't want to get your emotions to, you know, dominate here. You want to go and look at clear, which I have to give Dr. Kinner a lot of credit. He seems to be calm, you know, very balanced.
Sane.
And absolutely. Yeah. So I'm open to the fact that there's miracles. You seem to present a lot of good evidence for miracles, a lot of credible evidence. So, but my problem is this. In the New Testament, we don't have the x-rays and the CAT scans and the, you know, counter testimony that we do in your book. What we have is testimonial evidence, which is not objective evidence. We have, and let me give you an illustration. I'm not going to go to the resurrection. It's too controversial, too much emotional stuff there. In Mark, you have Jesus walking on the water. Where he walks on the water, everybody's like stunned and so forth. And the problem is in Matthew, you have Jesus walking on the water, but you also have Peter walking on the water. And in Matthew's gospel, there's a commentary where the disciples go and worship him as God. So what we have is not necessarily contradictory evidence, but what we have is not consistent evidence. And we have to realize Mark was written in about 70 AD. We have, this is testimonial evidence that was handed down. According to Papias, Mark was Peter's secretary. So it just, I would like it to be much more consistent. Does that cause you any problems, Dr. Kinner?
No, I'm a New Testament scholar. In terms of testimony, in terms of eyewitness claims, that's a form of evidence in sociology, anthropology, journalism, law, and historiography. I mean, what I do with New Testament, a lot of it is related to historiography. And we would know barely anything about the ancient Mediterranean world or many other parts of the world apart from testimony. Now, in terms of what testimony is the best, I mean, testimony has to be evaluated, but it is a level of evidence by itself. Now, in the case of the Gospels, if Mark is written around 70, I dated a little bit earlier, but it's just a few years either way. Most people dated around 70, give or take.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but that's within a generation of the events, which is actually fairly rare in terms of surviving extant literature from antiquity. It's also within the period that oral historians speak of as living memory. So when the eyewitnesses are alive, or people who knew the eyewitnesses are alive. Oral historians say, some of them make this distinction between oral history and oral tradition. Oral tradition is after the people who knew the eyewitnesses are dead. When you're still within a generation, you're still fairly close to the events. Now, both in psychological memory of an individual and in social memory, you have things kind of condensed. So it's usually the basic features that get remembered. People aren't going to remember the chronology, this event happened before this event. They may remember the place, but usually not the exact timing. And yeah, it's usually just some of the major features of that. For one account to include some things that aren't in another account, omission isn't the same thing as contradiction. No. So you can see them as complementary. Now, I do think that there's more going on than that, because just like, when Lee, when he's giving the hours that we spent together, and in the book he's talking about, Craig Keener said this, obviously it's an edited form. So he's emphasizing the side of it that is going to be most relevant for the point that he's making. The gospel writers do the same thing. And we have that all over the place. And actually, ancient writing, we find out that sometimes they could actually, more so in biographies than in other forms of historiography, but they could actually move some things around from one passage to another. So those things don't surprise me at all. It's in every layer of gospel tradition. So you have it in Mark. You have it in some material that's shared by Matthew and Luke that most scholars call Q, although that all that is disputed. But you have it in special material in each of the four Gospels. You have it, of course, in Acts. Paul mentions miracles happening. 2 Corinthians 12:12, everywhere that he, in 2 Corinthians 12:12, he says, "You Corinthians, you witnessed this when I was among you." Romans 15:19, he says, "Everywhere where I was starting new churches, this was happening." You have the detractors of early Christianity talking about it, although they may be depending on Christian sources there, but Celsus and later rabbis. Josephus, writing in the first century in his Antiquities 18:63 and 64, when he describes Jesus, the way that most scholars have reconstructed it, stripping out the extra stuff that's not in the earliest
period, right.
It speaks of Jesus as a sage and a worker of paradoxa, which is the same term that Josephus uses elsewhere for Elisha's miracles. So Geza Vermish, an Oxford Jewish historian, that was one of the main features that he used to argue, okay, most scholars agree Jesus was experienced by his contemporaries as a miracle worker. Now that doesn't resolve the question of whether these are actually divine miracles, but the idea is that his contemporaries experienced him that way. That's how they thought of him, as a miracle worker and a deliverer from evil spirits.
Sure. My next question is, I'm sure you're familiar with Johnny Erickson, the girl that broke her neck when she had a diving accident, dedicated her life to Christ, and said that she prayed to God that, "I want to get closer to you." And how did he answer her prayer? Her neck's broken. But she said that she would rather be in that condition, be closer to God, than to be, to be well, to be healed. So she describes a story where she's at the Pool of Siloam, where Jesus healed a leper, whatever, the person that was crippled. So what a scene. She's there. You would think, God, of all people, someone that has dedicated her life to spreading the word, couldn't God have given her a break? Because obviously she didn't get healed, and she prayed for healing at the Pool of Siloam right there when she went on her trip to Israel. Doesn't that seem like God could have given her a break?
Now, this could be a very long answer, but I'm going to give
I'm listening.
A sample answer, because I can't do it all right now. But And I do have sympathy for that. I mean, my wife and I have been through a series of miscarriages, and yeah, I mean, the real world in which we live obviously is a world in which suffering is the norm. The healings are the exception. And from a Christian perspective, what the healings are meant to do, they're not a panacea for all of the world's problems. Jesus multiplying food was probably, I mean, on that occasion it was great, but it probably teaches us more about caring about people's hunger, and a lot of his healings teach us about caring for people's health and so on. But in terms of Christian perspective, there's coming a day when Jesus will bring perfect healing to the world. But these other miracles are reminders of that. They're a foretaste of that, to remind us that God hasn't forgotten his promise. They're not in themselves meant to solve all of our problems. And I think Johnny's testimony, her own testimony about how God has used it in her life. I mean, she's become such a great advocate for people with disabilities and so on. It looks to me like God has done more through her with her disability than he may have done through her without it.
Great. Well, that really makes sense. I want to go to Ken Daniels if we can, because he's the guy that was a missionary to Africa and later became an atheist. He's a kind of a skeptic, so bear with him, okay?
Well, I was one before, you know.
So there he goes. So, but he has a lot better perspective on this than I do. So go ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Keener, for making time to be here with us. It's a real honor. But I was in Africa, in the country of Niger, edge of the Sahara Desert, with Wycliffe Bible Translators, up until 2000, when I started to have doubts about my faith and then left at that point. And I've been pretty much an agnostic since then. I did find the book, the Least Trouble book. I didn't read your two-volume work, but I found the interview fascinating. Especially was intrigued by the Barbara Snyder healing, apparent healing from multiple sclerosis. My question was, because I have lots of potential questions, but my first one was going to be, you mentioned that hundreds of millions of people have reported miraculous experiences. In your view, are most miracle claims bona fide supernatural events? And what proportion, if any, would you consider to be misperceptions, exaggerations, or misrepresentations?
The second part of that is easier than the first part, because the first part depends on how we define a miracle. So obviously from a Christian perspective, with providence, you know, there's general divine action all around us. But with regard to special divine action, then the question is, how special does it have to be to qualify? So there may be a continuum. In terms of things that are like really dramatic, I was really surprised by how many of the claims, once I started interviewing people, you know, well, have you ever seen a miracle? And then finding out what they meant by that, you know, I was expecting them to, you know, be something like, you know, my headache went away one time when I prayed, but some of them were pretty significant. I didn't run into a lot of this, but obviously we know that there's a lot of fraud that goes on as well, especially where there's money involved. That doesn't come usually so much from the ordinary people you talk with who say, you know, this is what happened to me when somebody at my church prayed for me. So the big central section of the book where I was reporting, here are the kind of claims that people make, that wasn't meant to be like all of these are bona fide miracles. I did say that in the book, but I think some people dipped in here and there and didn't see that qualification. There are some that I think meet a very high bar of evidence, some that have medical documentation. There are like, there may be 15-20% that I wouldn't want to consider at all, that I would just screen out.
Well, I just had a follow-up that related to an experience that I perceived was seemed to be miraculous at the time. In the church that I attended in North Carolina before we went overseas, there was a lady who had been wheelchair bound for a couple of years. She was not able to stand up. Her muscles were atrophied. And then one day, as she was praying and listening to Christian music, she was able to stand up and had her strength back. And she was in our church. She knitted a blanket for our firstborn son. We knew her. She was well-liked. So I decided to write to the pastor of the church in North Carolina that we had attended at the time to ask him if he had any information on any follow-up, any view on what had happened. And he wrote back and said that it had all been a fraud. What other stories can fall apart? I was curious to know the Barbara Snyder case, so I did some Googling, and I just really couldn't find much information about it.
Yeah, let me address that real quick. I do have a 11-minute video of Barbara Snyder. I was able to locate that, and actually what happened is that Lee Strobel has gone back and interviewed her since, and I think it's very interesting. I know you're real careful, Ken, and I know you want to be balanced on this, and I appreciate that. It's one thing that I appreciate about you. So it kind of works both ways in the sense that I'm the same way. If you can disprove quite a few of them, then you want to say, which pretty much means the whole lot of them are fraudulent. But the stories told about the Rolex watch being the most counterfeited watch in the history of the world, and there's so many fake Rolexes now. Most experts agree there's no such thing as a genuine Rolex. So you don't want to go that far, obviously. In the other way I think that would cut is to say for certain that there are no miracles, would you have to debunk every one of them? Or can you just debunk 10% and then kind of make a blanket statement? You know, Craig's not saying that they're all valid. He's reporting what he's, the stories that he's getting. And he would be the first one to say that we need to be skeptical.
Yeah, there was a chapter where I was trying to give some guidelines for, well, actually there were a few chapters where I was trying to give guidelines for how to evaluate. But Ken, what you did in following up is the kind of thing that needs to be done. Sometimes, well, we do what we can with the evidence that we have, but in the case of Barbara Snyder, I did contact two of the doctors that worked on her case back at the time, and also there was another one who actually published on it, and so I have his published material. Actually, two of them published on it, and then one of those who published, actually I think all three of them wrote about it, but I was able to interview two of them, and both of them were very clear about what happened, and there are other cases as well. There's somebody just this past year. He had been paralyzed on his, I believe it was his left side, for 10 and a half years. And it was actually a doctor who pointed out his story to me, that he got to a certain place of prayer and was being prayed for. And at that point, he was suddenly healed. And he walked around the room. We have a video of him doing it. I have a statement, not just from the doctor who told me about it, but from the doctor who was his doctor, who actually wrote, okay, this was his condition before, this was what happened afterwards, and I don't know what to call it except a miracle. And I have the statement from the doctor. So there are a number of cases like that. As well as what you said, there are fraudulent cases as well.
Brady, do you have someone lined up for another question for Dr.
Yes. Yeah, we actually, and I appreciate everybody responding on the chat there. Yes, we have John.
So, Dr. Keener, I had been told, your book includes many miracle stories. I had been told one of them by somebody who had read it and found it very persuasive, the story of a doctor who said that a 10-year-old girl's club foot straightened before my very eyes while an evangelist prayed for her. I looked into the story and discovered that it came from a Jamie Buckingham book, Daughter of Destiny, about faith healer Catherine Kuhlman. I may be mispronouncing her name, who is perhaps most famous, well, among things she's famous for is being the inspiration for and early supporter of Benny Hinn. Is she somebody you found particularly credible, and why would that story be in the book? That strikes me as a poorly evidenced story, but perhaps I'm wrong.
Well, the story is citing a doctor based on Jamie Buckingham's interviews with the doctor. Now, I'm not a fan of Benny Hinn. And actually, before I started doing the research, I thought that Catherine Coleman was a nut. But what I found, there actually are medical reports. So there's a book by Richard Kasdorf, MD, PhD, where he includes medical documentation for a number of the miracles that took place through Catherine Coleman's ministry. Now, obviously, most people who went to her meetings did not get healed, and she herself said that. But there were some that were rather dramatic, and one of them is a case of Lisa Larios, who was dying of cancer of the hip, and went to one of those meetings, and nobody actually prayed for her, nobody actually laid hands on her, but in that context of people praying for the sick, Lisa Larios jumped out of her wheelchair and started running around. Now, you could say that's just adrenaline, but at that point, her hip was so far gone that she shouldn't have been able to have done that. She walked home, shocking her father, walking into the room, pushing her wheelchair. Kasdorf provides the x-rays that show that not only was she healed of hip cancer, but where her bones had been eaten away by the cancer, the bones had actually been restored.
You might remember reading the book that in the interview that Lee Strobel had with Dr. Keener, Craig mentioned a case that was not part of his two-volume work, but was very interesting. I think, Ken, you said it was the most impressive one that you read, the story of the woman, Barbara Snyder. And subsequently, Lee Strobel has gone back and interviewed her, and he played that a portion of that interview, and I felt it was very remarkable. And what I wanted to do is just have you comment on that. Is that one of the, in your research, that stands out with some of the best evidence or one of the more remarkable stories?
Yeah, because there's some places in the world where it's really hard to get medical documentation. It's hard to get the documentation of what the person had to begin with, because there's just not enough medical help. But where it's available to get it is very important. And this is one of the cases where we have the reports from the doctors. And actually, but I think the way Barbara told it to me wasn't that her father came into the room and started waltzing her, but rather she said, "Dad," and he thought it was her sister because, you know, he knew that Barbara couldn't talk. And he said, "Oh, just a minute, I'll be right there." And then she realized, I don't have to wait for him. And she ran out of the room to him. And meanwhile, one of her friends was like, "Wait, you can't do this. You can't do this." He's dragging the oxygen tank behind. And she runs up and then embraces her father. And then that's when they waltz around the room. And I think actually went outside and did it some more in 93-degree weather. Mm. She said she never felt so good.
Wow. It's a fascinating story. Brady, who do we have queued up next?
Well, Bill will be delighted because we actually have Chris. He's next up on the queue.
Oh, good.
So glad to throw you right under the bus then, Chris.
I like being under the bus. It's cozy. I've got a sleeping bag and everything. Oh, yeah. Well, thank you, Dr. Keener, for joining us and being very gracious with your time. How do we tell when God is actually acting in a situation, as you call it, I think special divine action was the phrase you used. How do we tell that God has actually acted as opposed to us using our notions of how God works in the world or supposedly works in the world to fit a previously unknown phenomena into the category of miracle, when perhaps more appropriately it should stay as an unknown until we can, like I said, connect more of those dots to say it might, to say with more certainty that it might have been God acting.
Thanks, Chris. There's an atheist medical historian by the name of Jacqueline Duffin, who has a book on medical miracles, working from Catholic archives, Vatican archives. And she's an atheist, but she says these are miracles in terms of how we define miracles normally. So it is true. Sometimes we do have to live with some cognitive dissonance. And as Christians, we often do that too. I mean, there are a lot of things. I have a good friend who, Nabil Qureshi, who died of cancer. And like, okay, the big picture, there may be an explanation, but it's really painful on a small level. And we all, I think, live with some cognitive dissonance because we don't have all the answers for everything. And we have gaps in between some of the data points. And the way we reconstruct, the way we fill them in, is based on our worldview. So in the case of miracles, I think we have enough data points to point us in a theistic direction, but I know not everybody agrees with that. But, and also when I started working on the book that I mentioned earlier, I was only going to argue for the first premise, that eyewitnesses clearly claim these things. I wasn't going to make an argument for belief in special divine action, because that's a different kind of book. I mean, I'm dealing with philosophy of religion, philosophy of science, and all sorts of other things that, and not just what I needed for my historiographic case. But at a certain point, it seemed to me that the evidence became so overwhelming. You know, initially I'm using the kind of training that I had in terms of, you know, as a scholar, you start with a certain amount of skepticism. You press as far as you can with the skepticism. Whatever's left standing, you say, that is really strongly sure. And, you know, then you have degrees of things that are less sure and some things that are surely wrong. But at a certain point, the evidence to me became so overwhelming that I didn't start. Like, if you start with the idea that miracles are impossible unless proven otherwise, depending on what level of proof you're willing to accept, then you're going to explain away everything you can. Because to say that miracles don't happen because, or to say that we can never trust something as a miracle because of uniform human experience, once you realize that the human experience isn't so uniform, you don't feel compelled to dismiss those cases. I'm not saying that's what you're doing, because we've only actually given a couple cases. I could give a bunch more, but we understand, and a biblical worldview is also that there is sin and death in the world, there's suffering in the world. The Bible seems to take that for granted. But also from a biblical worldview, I think it explains some things that are, the problem of suffering, I think, is more of a problem on the Christian side. The problem of meaning and miracles, I think, where they do happen, meaning and purpose, and there's actually good in life that has eternal value, those, I think, are more of a problem for the skeptical side.
Well, let me do this if I can. I did want to be able to hear more to follow up from last month about the Duane Miller situation. Pastor Miller is with us in the room right now. We were able to see a couple of videos actually where he shared his story and how his voice was healed, and the Against All Odds happened to be on tape. And so what I want to do is show you just a little, about 3 minute little clip of the podcast that Brady Blevins interviewed Duane Miller. We're going to hear from him in a minute too, hopefully. And it was part of a podcast that we have available. And if you want to catch that whole podcast, if you go to watchman.org/podcast or anywhere that podcasts are served up. You can watch the whole thing. This is about a 3-minute little clip from the podcast. And then I want to show you that final clip after that.
We're asking the question today, are miracles possible? And I have a special guest with me, Dwayne Miller. Dwayne, I want to ask you today, are miracles possible?
Yes, they are. Let me tell you what happened to me. I had lost my voice to a virus, a simple flu virus. It got into the nerves of my vocal cords and destroyed nerve tissue. It was something from which I had been told by the best specialists from all over the world over a 3-year period, there was no way I would recover. It was impossible. In fact, they predicted that by the 4th year, the scar tissue that was forming in my throat would so completely overwhelm that I would lose the voice altogether and I would be totally mute. God chose to intervene, and as you can hear, I'm speaking pretty clearly.
How many doctors did you end up seeing?
63 physicians that I saw, but plus their teams. So with their teams, I saw over 200 physicians. Better way to say it, over 200 of them saw me.
Okay, how long did you go without your voice?
So it was 3 full years that I was compromised.
But they weren't 3 easy years for you psychologically or even spiritually.
Not at all. It was a pit experience on every level. 2 days before God restored my voice to me, Brady, I sat on a sofa in my living room with a shotgun in my mouth. I had reached the point of telling God, I can't take this anymore. I want out. And I had no idea what he had planned for 2 days later.
Well, what happened on Sunday?
On Sunday, I was trying to read the 103rd Psalm, and I had a special microphone, and the windscreen was literally on my lips, and I was screaming at it at the top of my lungs. And I said,
on the other hand, to say that, since we don't have anything after the book of Acts, that miracles ended at the book of Acts and they never happen again, is equally as wrong. Because you have put God in a box both ways, and he doesn't want to be in the box. So the psalmist says, I'm excited, bless the Lord, O my soul. One of his benefits is he heals all of my diseases. And then in verse 4 he says, and he redeems my life from the pit. Now I like that verse just a whole lot. I have had, and you have had in times past, pit experiences.
And the pit on that word, God took the pressure that had been in my throat for 3 years and removed it, and it was gone. And I could speak as clearly as I'm speaking right now on the next word. So it was there and it wasn't there. Nothing more, nothing less, just God.
And I appreciate that so much, and your willingness to tell us so much of the story of your true pit experience. As you suffered through the loss of your voice and then the appreciation to God that you've shown in his sovereignty through all this. So, Dwayne, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for allowing me to be here. It's been an honor.
The psalmist says, I'm excited. Bless the Lord, O my soul. One of his benefits is he heals all of my diseases. And in verse 4, he says, and he redeems my life from the pit. Now, I like that verse just a whole lot. I have had, and you have had in times past, pit experiences. We've all had times when our life seemed to be in a pit, in a grave. And we didn't have an answer for the pit we find ourselves in. And I don't understand this right now. I'm but overwhelmed at the moment. I'm not quite sure what to say or do. I'm sounds funny to say at a loss for words. Thank you, Lord. He redeems my life from the pit.
Well, so that was Dwayne's story. And again, if you go to the podcast, you can listen to the whole interview and get a lot more information on that. But let me see, Dwayne, thanks for joining us. I know you wanted to be with us last month as well. Tell us a little bit about the scar tissue.
The miracle in my being able to speak, guys, is more in the removal of the scar tissue from my throat than it is in my vocal ability. Let me say that the word miracle is almost anathema to me because of the sensationalism that has been associated with it. I really hesitate to even use the word. And when I go to tell my story, I generally call it that. Let me tell you my story. It's what happened to me. And I'm kind of like the blind man. I'm not sure who he is or where he came from, but here's what I know. What I know is I was blind and now I can see. And what I know is that my voice was gone and the scar tissue that had formed from me trying to talk and not being able to use the vocal folds, but the false cords, the scar tissue that had formed there. Baylor College of Medicine had kept a video record for that 3 years and it was massive. And when I went to see the doctor 2 days after that Sunday, was the following Tuesday morning, and they shot further video of it at that point, and the scar tissue was gone. My throat was as smooth and slick and perfect as the day it all began. And that for me is where the miracle is, because scar tissue, as I've talked to all my doctors, scar tissue doesn't go away on its own. That's what makes it scar tissue. It hangs around, it's there, and it doesn't dissipate. And as I thought, and over time, scar tissue is to the body, in a sense, what sin is to the soul. You can't get rid of it. It's going to be with you. And when you die, if you have a scar on your body, you're going to die with that scar. And unless Christ comes to a life to forgive sin and cleanse it, it'll be there when you die. But when he comes, it's instantaneously gone. And the only thing that I am, if I can ascribe purpose to all of it, the only thing I am is an object lesson of what it means to be forgiven. That's it. There's nothing special about Dwayne Miller. I will tell you that if there was ever anybody who was not looking for a quote miracle, it was me. When I was young, I began singing professionally when I was 16. And most of those evangelists that we all look askance at, I'll choose my words carefully, paid me to sing for them. And so I have been in many of those meetings. When I was very young, I sang for Catherine Kuhlman in one of her meetings in Detroit, Michigan. So I have been familiar with, and please understand how I mean it, I've been familiar with the show, and I want nothing to do with it, nothing whatever to do with it. And so when I lost my voice, I had resolved with God, not the way I had planned my ministry. I had been a pastor, teacher, etc., and now the vocal abilities appeared were going to go completely away. And if that was the way it was, that's just the way it was. I believed that God had a plan and I would leave it with him, kind of like Johnny. I'm prepared to do whatever. I had done radio in Houston for Salem Broadcasting, and Johnny and I had a wonderful conversation subsequent to my voice restoration on my radio program. There's also an evangelist named David Ring. And David has a cerebral palsy, profound. And he and I did several conferences together. And we would talk about the grace of God. And David would talk about the grace of God to sustain. And I would talk about the grace of God to intervene. And it was a rather interesting picture of the grace that we would put together. But the point of all of that is this, guys, there was no one praying for me that morning. I was teaching a Sunday school class. That Sunday school class was about 300 people. First Baptist Church Houston is a mega church. And I had been a part of that church for 26 years, give or take. And that event, by the way, was 28 years ago, this last January. So God has sustained my voice. It wasn't momentary. And now I'm pastoring and back to doing ministry things that I love to do. I will field questions. I don't guarantee that I can answer them. I do have one fundamental premise, and it comes from Hebrews 11. And it was simply this, that without faith, it's impossible to please God. So there are things that I can't explain. I leave them with him. I don't blame him for things that I can't explain. I don't try to put him in a box. That's what I was talking about that morning. There are things that I can't tell God to behave himself. He just won't do it. He's going to be God and I'm not. And I'm comfortable to leave it there. But that's my story. And that's how I live in my life. And I know that doesn't speak for everyone, and I'm okay with that.
Dwayne, I had a question for you. I know that you believed in miracles, at least theoretically, way before this.
Right.
But you're not saying, I've got to hear the whole interview. I was there for the interview, that you had some kind of super faith and your faith was greater than these other people. And so that's why God bestowed this upon you. You were kind of like a lot of Christians, and I find myself in the category a lot. I believe that God can perform miracles. I just don't expect them.
That's it.
And so it's just like, yeah, in theory, sure, God can do that. And so tell us how you went into there. You weren't preaching the message. Reading it says right there, he heals our diseases. But you weren't thinking, oh, this means that I'm going to be healed right now. You were as surprised as anyone, right?
Probably more than anyone else. No, the hyper faith is what I run from. That's the one thing that I cannot tell you how against that teaching I am. I don't have sufficient superlatives.
What do you can you quickly tell us what you mean by hyper faith?
The guys who would say that I was healed because I had more faith than somebody else, that's hyper faith. That I deserve
faith in faith. You have faith in your own faith.
Correct. It's faith in faith and faith in an outcome. I don't have faith in an outcome. I have faith in God. I don't know what the outcome is going to be. I did learn through this experience in that 3 years, you don't know what you believe until you hit an experience that you can't control. When you hit the wall, that's when you're going to find out what you really believe.
Yeah, you didn't believe in suicide either, but you find yourself with a
shotgun. That's exactly right. And I had a shotgun in my mouth. My thing was, I guess succinctly say it, I had no doubt that God can heal, absolutely no doubt in his power. But whether he would heal me was a whole different question and a whole different conversation. Whether that was part of his plan, I didn't expect it. And in fact, there wasn't anybody in that room that was more surprised than I was. If you listen to that tape very carefully, the first thing you hear is you'll hear me swallow. And it was the first time in 3 years that I could swallow without feeling like I was being choked. And the first thought that went through my mind, I love Barbara Stewart's story because she was very, very fleshly in her responses, and so was I. The first thought that went through my mind was, is that what I think it is? Because I wasn't expecting that, and I didn't think I would ever hear it again. And I said a few words, and you'll hear me pause, and you can actually, if you're listening carefully, you can hear it when it starts to dawn on me what is actually happening to me, because I did not expect it, anticipate it. Nobody was praying for me. We weren't in that kind of a situation at all.
I was teaching a Sunday school lesson that had gone on the program 7 years before. It wasn't something that I picked out for that morning. That was just standard Southern Baptist biblical curriculum. That's what I was teaching. And I was using a special microphone, and that was the last Sunday I was going to teach because my voice had gotten so weak and it hurt so bad to do it that I had just gotten to the point of saying, this will be the last week, I'm done. So I was literally down to the wire. That was another reason why the shotgun on Friday is I felt like my whole world, because I knew that Sunday was going to be the last Sunday I was going to teach. So even that was going to go away. My world was smaller and smaller and smaller.
Dr. Keener, I wanted to ask you a question about that whole situation. And you know, Dwayne in the interview talked about, it was like, of all the problems in the world, why me? Why do you make a special miracle just for me? And it's like, you don't feel worthy, and but you also hear sometimes from skeptics a pushback that if God's going to miraculously fix a sprained ankle, doesn't he owe to save all the starving children? And it's like he wastes the miracles on trivial things and doesn't take care of the important things. You hear that kind of...
I mean, I can answer in principle some of the reasons why God may not heal everybody in this life, but why in particular this person and not that person. In terms of the people I interviewed, this didn't go into the two-volume work, but I kept notes for my own interest's sake in terms of where they were coming from theologically, and it was all across the board. I mean, these were people who loved Jesus, but they didn't all have the same theology about miracles. And I think God doesn't heal us because we know everything, or we have all of our theology straight, but it's a sign of his love. And these miracles biblically are samples. Like when Jesus was healing people in Matthew 11:5 and Luke 7:22, Jesus is answering the messengers of John the Baptist, who said, are you the one to come, or should we look for somebody else? And he answers them basically from scripture. I mean, he uses phrases taken from Isaiah 35 and Isaiah 61 to talk about the promised future, the kingdom, when God is going to restore the earth, he's going to restore his people, and so on. He uses this language of the kingdom, and he speaks of the healings that he's doing now because these were signs of the kingdom. They're a foretaste of the time when he's going to wipe away all tears from our eyes.
I do want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart to Dwayne Miller for joining us, and also for Craig Keener, gracing us with your presence to help bring light on this. I think especially Dr. Keener, you probably got some pretty tough questions this time, and I thought you handled them very well. And I want to appreciate everybody. Raise your hand. Not many cameras are on right now. How many of you, this is your first time to be part of the Atheist Christian Book Club? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 here. Okay, so we have new people every month. Welcome to the club. And I want to encourage you to be back next month. Thank you for being very gracious on both sides, Christians and atheists, in how you treated your questions and our guests. And until next month, thank you for being part of the Atheist and Christian Book Club. Thanks so much.
To find out more about the book club, guest speakers, previous meetings, upcoming discussions, and how you can join a meeting for free, visit atheistchristianbookclub.com. That's atheistchristianbookclub.com. Why not consider financially supporting Apologetics Profile today for as little as a few dollars a month? Visit patreon.com/watchmanfellowship today.